This is a More Than Just Podcast production.
Welcome to Spotcast Season 4, Episode 20. My name is Tim Mitra. I am in Toronto, Ontario, and I'm joined once again by Jonathan Kuhlein in Mr. and Mississauga.
Greetings, children.
And we also have Hyman Lopez Jr. on the line in, wait for it, Seattle, Washington.
How's it going?
Just gonna let that sit there for a minute.
1002, 1003, 1004, and
not really a minute, a virtual minute.
We're good, Jaime. How are you?
We're fine. It's going pretty well. Anyway, so we'll start off with some fact check. Douglas Gilmore was born June 25th, 1963, in Kingston, Ontario.
Oh, getting old, forgetting stuff like that.
I know. And then the other children of Kingston, this is just some of them, just the ones that were notable to me. Brian Adams, mm-hmm. Wayne Cashman from
the photographer, Brian Adams?
No, I don't think he might have a camera. I don't know. It's some guy who sings songs.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know who he is. Wayne Cashman, who was on the Stanley Cup winning team in 1970 with the Boston Bruins. Don Cherry, right? Paul Coffey. Mm. Gord Downie, of course, lead singer from the... and of course, I didn't list all the Tragically Hip guys, too, yeah. But there you go. Hugh Dillon, who's another famous
from the Headstones,
Sarah Harmon, who's a singer people like. Jane Heffert, who is
Sarah
now a...
Sarah Harmer.
It's typo. It's like whatever. It's like...
Sarah Harmer from...
I know. I said Sarah Harmer.
Okay.
Even though it says Harmon here, but that's...
Scandalous.
A lot of time talking about that. Jane Heffert, who is now... I believe she is now a member of... Didn't we see her inducted into the... No, that was Wickenhauser, right? But I'm pretty sure Heffert is in the Hockey Hall of Fame.
That's a good question. Yeah, I'll look that up while you do your thing.
Yeah, John A. Macdonald, who was the notably first Prime Minister of Canada, also shares a birthday with somebody on this podcast. Bruce Macdonald, director. Kirk Muller, who was also I think he was a Montreal Canadian for a long time. Was he a Canadian? Was he a Toronto Maple Leaf at one point?
Kirk Muller, yeah. He was both. Yes, Jaina, inducted into the Hall of Fame in 2018.
Yeah. Harry Sinden was the coach of the Stanley Cup winning 1970 Boston Bruins, but he's also the Canadian coach of the original, what was it called? Was that the Summit Series?
72 Summit Series, yeah.
Yeah, 72. And yeah. David Usher, who Jonathan likes as a singer, or used to at least, at one point in time.
Yeah.
You've interviewed him a few
very
times,
talented.
Right?
I have, yes. I've met David. He's a very, very nice man and very talented at that.
Cool. All right. And I was a little bothered by another piece that Jonathan said, la, 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 in America. And I thought, you know, that doesn't sound like something Stephen Sondheim would write. So
it's
I went
100% of the song. I put it in the link below.
I'm going to have to disagree with you because...
It may not be in the lyrics, but it's in...
Karaoke lyrics. I looked at the actual stage play lyrics and I looked at the actual movie lyrics.
Okay. Well, have you played...
And they don't say la, 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 la in America.
That's no, they say la, 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 America, America.
Where?
It's in the lyrics.
That's the lyrics for karaoke. That's not... That's like saying it's in Wikipedia.
Mm. All right. This debate...
Yeah, I'm looking. I don't see la, 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 la in America anywhere. Oh, at the very end. All right. You mean it's like a background vocal or something?
Yeah, I think it's just like something that they do as they're like, you know, freestyling and dancing.
All right. Well, I guess the karaoke world wins over Stephen Sondheim, I guess, you know. Well, it's on the internet, so it's got to be true, right?
That's true. Yeah. I mean,
yeah.
If it was published on Wikipedia, it'd be more official.
Yeah. On that happy note, probably is, but let's have a look. On that happy note, let's move to the headlines. And JPK, you're up first.
Yeah, so we've been speculating about what's going to happen with the upcoming Spider-Man movie No Way Home. It looks pretty apocalyptic. We know we're going to get all kinds of bad guys from Spider-Man films past. Looks like we're probably going to get other Spider-Men from previous movies in there. But what I had postulated was, wouldn't this be a good opportunity to do the sort of death of Spider-Man arc and maybe move past the mantle onto Miles Morales in the big screen as opposed to the or in the live action as opposed to the cartoon universe where we already have a Miles franchise. And Apparently that's not happening. So EW.com, Entertainment Weekly, had a piece this week where they were talking to the, they were talking about the new movie, and they were talking about an interview with Amy Pascal, who's the producer of the franchise. And she said, this is not the last movie we're going to make with Marvel. This is not the last Spider-Man movie. We're getting ready to make the next Spider-Man movie with Tom Holland and Marvel. We're thinking this is three films, and now we're going on to the next three. This is not the last of our MCU movies. So we are going to have a new Spider-Man trilogy, and Tom Holland is not moving on to greener or uncharted pastures, if you will.
Just let that one hang there for a little bit.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. I'll be here all week. Don't forget to tip your waitress.
I was going to say, are you trying to say he's staying with the franchise?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I mean, that's, she didn't say anything in here about obviously, what this is going to be, how they're going to do it, but it sounds like they're committed to this partnership between Sony and Disney, and there's going to be three more Tom Holland Spider-Man movies. So
interesting.
I guess he's not gonna bite the big one in this next movie. So take that off the table, which is almost a little disappointing. I wish he kind of waited till afterwards just because it would have been nice. Well, but it's true though. Like you kind of want that element of risk. Like maybe they will. Like in a cinematic series where they, killed half the universe and turned a bunch of characters, including Spider-Man, to dust, you got to keep the stakes high, right? I think it would have been more impactful to not confirm this before that movie came out.
Well, it sounds like they don't understand the whole marketing side of, and I mean, was that really on the table? Like, were people really speculating about the fact that he was going to leave the show or die or whatever?
There had been no confirmation of what they were going to do next with Spider-Man.
I'm pretty sure in the trailer he does actually catch Mary Jane or whatever her name is as she's falling.
No, we see him just millimeters away from it.
Yeah. Yeah. But I'm going to how you say projecting, right? So.
Oh yeah. No, for sure. Again, that's the thing. If they give us these long lead ups, we take what we're given and we try and extrapolate, right?
So the question I have though is, so Tobey Maguire, Andrew, what's
Garfield.
His name?
Garfield.
Yep. I mean, like, were they only signed up for three, or did the third movie do so badly that they decided to move on to a different story or a different arc or whatever? Like, why would those guys only have done three movies? Because this is pretty much the third or fourth appearance of Tom Holland, right?
This is, it's the third of his original his movies. Yeah,
he was in one of the...
He was in, three Avengers movies, or two Avengers movies plus Civil War, Captain America Civil War.
Yeah.
No, they didn't specifically, I must admit, I don't know all the details. I do remember I was obviously covering film back when Spider-Man 3 came out, and there was some discussion about doing a fourth one, but Sony wouldn't commit to it. With Tobey Maguire.
Yeah.
So Sony wouldn't commit to doing a fourth one because they weren't sure where they wanted to go with it. And Tobey Maguire was starting to get, show his age as Spider-Man a little bit. So I think they were a little bit reticent to commit to more. Sam Raimi, who directed the first trilogy, wanted to do four. He wanted to do a part three and a part four and sort of do them simultaneously as sort of one big story that contained the Sandman storyline from that movie and the Venom storyline from that movie. Sony said no. He said, fine, I'm going to shoehorn all this stuff into this movie and then I'm done. So he did, and Spider-Man 3 turned it to be a bit of a cacophonous mess because he tried basically to do two movies in one and it didn't work, in spite of the fact that he's a fantastic director. And so we ended up with a bad 3 that sort of didn't perform well, wasn't rated well. And then when he left, I think they sort of looked at it and said, okay, well, maybe it's time for us to hit the reset button on this whole thing. And that's why they went with the Andrew Garfield. The Andrew Garfield, again, started strong. The first one did very well. They got two young actors in Garfield and Emma Stone, who were sort of, starting to reach heights, and they hit them right at their right moment. Mm-hmm. But then, spoilers, they killed her in the second one, which was part of the longtime comics lore that Gwen Stacy dies. But it really backfired, and all the fans were like, oh my God, you killed Emma Stone. What the hell's wrong with you? And I think that movie turned out to be a bit of a flop. And just a bit of a downer for people too. And again, I think from that one, I think they were sort of not ready to do more. And then I think the negotiations heated up around, you know, the MCU was starting to really pick up. What are we going to do? And then all that spun into the Tom Holland version that we know now. So, but I think it's exciting. I mean, Tom Holland's, due respect to Tobey Maguire and Andrew Garfield, who I think both of them were, you know, good Spider-Man. I don't think they were bad Spider-Man. I think Tom Holland is the best cinematic one we've seen. Obviously, he, even though he's 25, I think now, he still looks quite young. He still plays quite young well. He's certainly, he's got a very endearing quality, and his chemistry with his other actors is great. He really captures, I think, a lot of what, you know, Spider-Man is in his performance, but also I think he's getting the best opportunities too. I think he's getting really good things to do as Spider-Man. So yeah, three more movies. I'm down. I'm way in. And again, hopefully three movies means three movies that are his, plus he'll be an Avenger, plus he'll be, you know, crossing into other people's movies, plus. So I think this is great.
Yep. No, it's good to have consistency. I mean, like, you know, if all of a sudden they decided to have somebody other than Hemsworth play Thor, it would seem weird, you know, at this point, because, you know, or like, you know, with Robert Downey Jr. as Iron Man, even though I know they can't do that anymore, but I mean, to have somebody else play that, you know, after establishing him for 10 years, you know, it would seem odd. And I mean, I still look at the new Flash guy and kind of go, that's not the Flash, you know, in the DC movies, you know what I mean? Right.
So, yeah. Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how they continue this stuff forward. Obviously, they've written out some characters, but one truth that all comic fans know is that no death is forever.
Yeah.
There are so few characters that have been killed in perpetuity. They've killed characters for decades, but everybody's on the table to come back. So they could do all kinds of ways to bring anybody back. But the difference between a comic book and a live action film is that it's awfully hard to keep people young forever. Now, we've seen them. They de-aged people for a bunch of these movies. So, you know, that's always on the table. But they've also introduced the concept of the multiverse, too. So is it just a matter of time before we see, you know, other iterations of other, you know, I'm the Tony Stark from Universe 26, and right, I've come to save the day. You know, there is an old Iron Man arc from way back when I was a boy, where, you know, they actually killed off Tony Stark and he was replaced with his younger self. So for a while there, Tony Stark was actually a teenager.
Hmm. Okay.
Yeah. Again, it can be pretty well done and pretty convoluted, but nobody's irreplaceable.
Well, I mean, like in comic books, do they actually have milestones like, you know, 9/11 and World War II? I mean, like, do they have like major milestones, mm-hmm, or do they just sort of leave the time loose?
Some things they do incorporate. Marvel made the call to incorporate 9/11 when it happened with an incredibly powerful issue, Amazing Spider-Man 36, volume 2, number 36, which features a pitch black cover. And, you know, Spider-Man swings down to the site of the Twin Towers and, you know, sort of deals with, you know, how did he not know this was going to happen? How could he not have done something? It, you know, it sounds a little hokey, but it's actually quite poignant. It's actually a really, really lovely story about how something like that could still happen in a universe where there are superheroes. Right.
Right.
And it's, you know, the truth is the same reason that could happen in the United States in the first place, that, you know, you cannot predict the actions of mad people.
Yeah, that's true. Well, I mean, it's interesting too that, you know, two tie-ins there is, one is that you remember the original trailer for Spider-Man before Tobey Maguire's Spider-Man came out was the Spider-Man catching the helicopter in between the two towers.
Between the two towers, yep. And they had to remove that because obviously people found it
Too soon or whatever.
Too soon, yeah.
I mean, it was just done shortly before that. Yeah.
Speaking of Spider-Man, as we are, our next headline dropped this evening. We got the first trailer for Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse Part 1. This is a sequel to Spider-Man Enter the Spider-Verse, which was the incredibly beautiful and, I mean, exquisite movie that came out a few years back by Lord and Miller that is centered around Miles Morales being Spider-Man and encountering all these other incarnations of Spider-People from across the multiverse. So this is our first taste of where that universe is going. In that one, obviously, Miles becomes the Spider-Man of his universe after the death of Peter Parker. He meets Spider-Gwen. He meets Spider-Ham. He meets Petey Parker, the mechanical Spider-Man. He meets Spider-Man Noir. And he meets the Peter Parker, the schlubby Peter Parker with the big gut. And it looks like we're going on more adventures in this one. Another glimpse at this really beautiful. I said it at the time. This was one of my favorite animated movies of all time. And beyond that, it is the closest I've ever seen to a comic book brought to life. Just the onomatopoeia, the way the panels move, the slight pixelization. So it looks like it's on a three color press. It's so, so beautiful to me, the way that they brought that feel to the film. And on top of that, it was just a beautifully told story about this young man and his life and the challenges and, you know, it was just really, really, really well done. So I was excited to see them drop this trailer tonight. What did you guys see? You guys, I know, had a chance to look at this earlier as well.
I mean, it does have the look and feel of the other film, like when he switches out of the scene show with him and Spider-Gwen. But when he dives out the window and you get the sort of full psychedelic effects, and yeah, I know a lot of people who are really obsessed with that actual movie because it had amazing sound and amazing visuals. Unfortunately, I saw it on an airplane, so I saw it on a little back of a matchbook. So I probably should watch it again on a big screen, but yeah, it does look pretty cool. I mean, and it is an interesting story. It plays with the idea of a multiverse better than most multiverse thingies do, because I mean, here they have like a cartoon multiverse and a...
Well, they could do anything, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's the nice thing about it, right? And you're right, it does have the sort of... It plays with the sort of ink mislined on paper kind of effects, as well as all the sort of, video... because they don't limit themselves to sort of realistic color palettes and that kind of stuff, and they get really artistic with it, and it really moves well that way, right?
Yeah, it does look really cool. I'm intrigued by the fact that it's a part one. I hope they are gonna already be well into getting the second part up and going, so that it's not like a 2 year, 3 year, 4 year kind of gap. Because this one comes out in October of 2022, so hopefully as they're wrapping up the post-production on this, they can do the same for that as well.
Yeah, and it's been a moment since the last one, too. I think, it would be good to see them, you're right, Jaime, do, a 1 year later or 6 months later as opposed to 3 years later. I wonder,
Lord of the Rings style, where it's like one every year sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, again, I think they really stumbled onto something incredible here. I was lucky enough that when the film came out in the theaters, it was a night where I believe it was pre-pandemic, and I believe our sons were spending the weekend maybe with you, Tim. And my wife said, hey, is there anything you want to do? And I said, I really want to see this movie in the theater. And she said, great, let's go see it. And she's not very much into this world that the three of us are. She's not a huge sci-fi, fantasy, comic booky kind of person, but she loved it. She thought it was fantastic because it's just a really lovely story filled with good characters, and it's a really unique vision. Again, I've never seen an animated movie like this that uses this style, that really mixes the media the way they do. Like, it really is a very unique vision. And combining that with a really heartfelt story, really, it was a home run. It was an absolute home run. So yeah, I'm excited to see where they go.
Yeah, it's definitely a work of art, that movie. Like, from the point of view, like you said, like even animations that were done back in the day, like National or Heart Heavy Metal or Felix the Cat, things like that, they're all sort of a single vision of, you know, art kind of thing. So even though they're animated, they stay within their lane, you know, but mm-hmm. this one kind of played with all the rules, you know?
Yeah.
Broke all the rules, I mean. Yeah.
Wait, so I might have misheard here when you were talking about heavy metal. Did you mean Fritz the Cat? Because I thought I heard Felix the Cat.
Oh, yeah.
No, Fritz the Cat, yeah.
Okay, that would make a little
Ralph
more Bashy's sense.
Who I was thinking of. I was thinking of Wizards and stuff like that. Wizards was another movie that was very similar in that he mixed things. In fact, I think he was involved in the original Lord of the Rings cartoon where the...
Oh, the one where they did the draw over and stuff? Yeah.
Yeah, so they had the human horses and stuff, but whenever they showed the ring race, they were always sort of really cool and sinister looking, but animated, you know, it was clear that they were doing, you know, it looked a little bit like those Saturday, like, you know, Frosty the Snowman kind of Rankin Bass kind of illustrations with, you know, other medias in there, but mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. yeah, still that was unique at its time, but yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, but this is exciting. Again, it's a long wait. We have to wait until all the way till next October to get this sequel finally. But exciting that they're going back to this, and exciting even more that this is listed as a part one.
October's when the part one's coming out, or October's when part two's coming out?
No, it's when part one's coming out. So we've got 10 months to kill before we get that next one, but I'm sure we'll find ways to keep ourselves amused.
Yeah. Actually, you know what I was going to go back to was the other point I wanted to make about, you know, the portrayal of, you sort of said the timeline and how, you know, Marvel brings in real life events. I'm having a really tough time watching movies where they don't talk about COVID at all. You know what I mean? Like, we're still, I mean, I know that they're filming like Red Note. I just watched an interview with Ryan Reynolds talking about how they were all, you know, cloistered in hotel rooms and they all had to, you know, do safe things. And yet in the movie, they're depicting life as normal pre-pandemic, you know?
It's true. But then, you know, I think right now TV and film is escapism, right? They really want. People want to not be in their reality right now because their reality is quite frustrating and quite grim. I think in this circumstance, I wouldn't want to see any of my shows with people wearing masks and having to deal with that because that's our reality. I want that escapism.
Right. Yeah, no, I was going to say because, you know, Carol and I both sort of started noticing when, you know, the masks started showing up in commercials, right? Because for like first 8 months of the pandemic, there was like no depiction of life changing, you know?
Yeah.
And yet now wearing a mask is like I was just watching a bunch of American protesters in front of the Lincoln Memorial wearing masks.
Yeah.
Like, when did masks become okay? Right. But, you know, it just like, and I just finished watching, I probably should talk about it in either the watch list or whatever, but the 8-bit Christmas, I did watch it.
I watched it too. Yeah.
Yeah, and that was an interesting movie, and I get in that case, I could see, okay, well, if you want to make a timeless classic, and that's kind of where that sort of movie is going to land, you know, you're always going to watch the Christmas, it's going to be on the rotation of Christmas movies, which seem to never end in Canada, I don't know if you noticed that, but you can always find a Christmas movie, right?
Yeah.
You know, it's like, in that movie, I kept looking at it going, these people are too close together,
but, you know. Yeah.
Anyway, it's just, you know, it's odd that, you know, like, you know, we can be upset about 9/11, but not something that killed even more people than 9/11. We just kind of brush it under the carpet.
Yeah, but again, it's there's certainly been no shortage of films made about the events of 9/11 after the fact. I'm sure there will be COVID films after the fact. I think the challenge is one, it's not over. We're still, who knows if we're even in the middle of it. We might still be in the beginning of it. We don't know. And you know, again, I think right now what most people are looking for, since they're spending so much more time at home and their, you know, their reality is so frustrating with the masks, vaccinations, anti-vaxxers, the dialogue online, restrictions. Who wants to live that in their films? I did notice 8-Bit Christmas, my wife and I watched it the other night, and we watched the credits after the film was over, and there was a whole section there about, you know, COVID, you know, the people who were responsible for maintaining COVID protocols. And she said, oh, that's the first time I think I've ever seen that on a production list. And I said, you know, yeah, they're starting to become more common that that's there. I don't know that they've obviously listed all those people, but I mean, frankly, they deserve as much or more credit than a lot of other departments working on a movie, because that's got to be incredibly complicated. I was watching 8-Bit Christmas, and there's certainly no shortage of scenes where there's a lot of people in one screen and stuff like that. Like, the logistics of that must be incredibly complicated. So again, I think you're right, though. I think you nailed it with the line that is, they were going for timeless Christmas classic, and you don't want to root it in 2021 by saying, oh, and there's Neil Patrick Harris sitting with his the actress playing his daughter, and they're both wearing masks when they go out, you know, when they're out shopping. Like, that just seems like,
but it's also like the line that he says, of course we wear helmets in the 80s when we were riding our bikes, you know, and of course he's got the Gretzky Jofa helmet on, right?
Did you watch it too, Jaime?
I did. I did happen to watch it.
The one line that really stuck out to us is both my wife and I were just like, come on. Is at one point the young boy who's playing young Neil Patrick Harris is trying to sell wreaths door to door to try and win this Nintendo. And he goes to the one place and the guy is pointing at a sign saying, you better not be trying to sell me anything. And he points at the no solicitation sign. Mm-hmm. And he says, you know, I wanted to see if you wanted to buy some wreaths. And he goes, do you have some kind of learning disability? I said, this is supposed to be 1989. That's not the word that comes out of his mouth.
That's not what they would have said, yeah.
The word that comes out of his mouth starts with an R and is really blacklisted now. But, you know, good try, though.
I thought you guys were going to talk about the Canadian accent that they use briefly.
Oh, my. Yeah. Well, yeah. That was a little dark also.
That was okay. That was not as bad as Yoga Hosers, you know?
Oh, I mean, but Yoga Hosers was deliberate too, right? Like, they were doing that on purpose, making fun of it.
True. Still bothers me every time I watch that movie.
Yeah.
But he did address it. Kevin Smith did talk about the Yoga Hosers accent, because, of course, he was in front of a Canadian audience, right? So he had to address it.
Yeah, I believe his exact line was, sorry.
Yeah. All right.
Next up. So there was a big dump of information around all these Star Wars and Marvel programs that were coming to Disney Plus, one of which was announced months and months and months ago, was going to be the spinoff from The Mandalorian called Star Wars Rangers of the New Republic. And at the time, the idea was put out there that Rangers of the New Republic was going to be centered around Mandalorian character Cara Dune, played by Gina Carano. She was going to sort of be the lead of this thing, and it was going to talk about her sort of life post-rebellion in the New Republic, trying to sort of, you know, now we've seen her as the Marshal and sort of getting back into that universe. Interesting idea. Well, in the time since they announced it, obviously Gina Carano has been canceled because she made some unfortunate comments on her social media, and she was basically unceremoniously dropped from future plans by Disney / Star Wars. So that left a lot of people saying, well, are they going to still do Rangers of the New Republic? Are they going to rewrite it? Are they going to do something else? This week, we got a story coming out of Empire Magazine where Kathleen Kennedy was interviewed, and she said that the show is no longer moving forward on its production schedule. She said that they hadn't written any scripts, that they were, you know, just sort of had enough of a good idea that they were going to pursue it, but given that what's happened, that they're going to talking about integrating some of the plot lines that they had in mind for it into The Mandalorian and then just scrapping it. Although she did say it has not been officially canceled. So it could still exist, but I think it's pretty fair to say that the Rangers of the New Republic is toast. Any thoughts on, are you sad? Are you happy? Do you care? Did you have high hopes for this one?
Yeah, I think it's a bummer to lose the content, but at the same time, there's just so much other good content that they have that I don't know that I'm struck by this. But, like, you know, if they end up canceling Ewan McGregor or something, they'll probably feel that a little lot more than Gina Carano's character.
Yeah. Tim, are you moved? Are you sad? Do you miss Gina Carano already?
I'm not really crushed at all. I mean, like, I don't really know the story of the Rangers of the New Republic. I haven't really probably caught up enough on, Rebels or finished the other one.
Clone Wars?
Clone Wars. Mm-hmm. So, and you know, of course, I know about her being canceled. So, I I'm not surprised. I thought Ahsoka was, what's her name? The young lady's
Rosario Dawson?
Yeah, no, what's the character?
For Ahsoka Tano?
Yeah, Ahsoka Tano. I thought Ahsoka was part of that show, or is she going to still have her own show?
Ahsoka's got her own show. They already announced that that's going to be a separate thing.
The reason I ask is because in the image they have here on the page, it's got, you know, it shows Ahsoka Tano, right?
Yeah.
Just to confuse everybody.
Yeah.
Yeah, not crushed.
Yeah,
I'm sure there's lots of Jedi. Well, are there lots of Jedi left? We're not really sure.
Yeah. That's a different issue.
Yeah.
All right. Well, our last headline this week, we've got the return of the Matrix. So we knew Matrix Resurrections is coming in a few short weeks. Looks pretty good. Trailers are out there. Commercials are popping up. And in order to get people ready, for the first time, you can watch the Matrix, the original 1999 film, The Matrix, in IMAX. So for 2 days only, on December 7th and 8th, you can go and watch.
Wait, that's this week?
That's next week. Yes, it is. Or depending on when you're listening to this, it might be today. Go now! It's apparently only in theaters for the 7th and 8th. You can go and you can watch the original film, The Matrix, in IMAX, which I gotta admit, it's kind of an intriguing proposition. Yeah,
definitely. It's a good movie.
Yeah, I mean, if there was a movie that was made to be seen on that kind of scope, it's pretty good. It's pretty good.
Why is it showing it to me at the 24 in Whitby?
I don't know.
Probably because that's where my internet's coming out.
Your VPN is set to Whitby?
Well, yeah, no, it just depends on where you're...
Yeah, it's where you're picking up the ping, right?
Yeah, why is it not coming? Why is Oakville not showing up as a choice? Is it only playing in Whitby? What's going on?
It may not be playing at every single theater either, right? It depends on if they have the capacity or if they're opting into this or whatever, right? Participating locations only.
Oh, here, wait. There's Perth. A few more theaters. Hang on a sec, folks, while we scroll through the list of theaters that are playing. What the hell? These are all like middle of nowhere. Calgary, Cardiff, UK, Kingdom. What is up with this? I guess I have to click on the locate, find a theater. we'll have to look into this a bit deeper. Oh, Dune is playing over there. That's why.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. I never knew that IMAX had their own.
Yeah, they have their own site where you can book stuff. Yeah.
Cool. Yeah, I wouldn't go see it at Cinesphere because the sound wouldn't be that great.
No.
No Siri Bob. The 7th and 8th, you said. Let's click on the 8th, see what happens. For 7th. 7th is Tuesday.
Yep.
It's Dune, Ghostbusters. Oh, here we go. Kitchener, we can go watch it in Kitchener.
Woo!
That's even further.
It's further than Whitby.
We'll let Jaime look that one up.
Oh my God, that's too far away.
Oh my God,
that's like driving to Vancouver, you know.
Yeah, turn left at Albuquerque. Alrighty. Well, this is the part of the show, folks, where we have arrived, where we start talking about the latest Star Trek thingy. And this week, the thingy is Discovery, Season 4, Episode 3, Choose to Live. And I have offered myself as tribute to do the recap.
You've been chosen.
Metaphors.
You've been chosen.
I've been chosen. So we start off with the USS Credence, commanded by Commander Fickett. Who's delivering dilithium to a planet as per, you know, the agreement that they would deliver dilithium to all the various planets after the burn. And they're immediately attacked. I love the autocorrect here. Stacked and killed. No, they are attacked and killed.
Or stabbed and killed.
By stacked dead actors, right? By some mercenaries led by a Kwat-Malat nun named Javini. And at one point she's fighting with them and she says to the commander, you know, please, my friend, choose to live, she says. And ironically, that's the name of the show, Choose to Live. And I thought, you know, as I was taking notes, I'm thinking that would be a really cool name for the show. And then it turned out to be that is actually the name of the episode. Unfortunately, he meets the end of her sword, which we'll talk about, you know, the path you're on and when it, this path comes to an end at some point, and you might find yourself the, at the end of the point of a Kwatmalat sword, which is where the choose to live, asking you to pick another path. But so we switch over to Vance, President Tirina. Is that right? I don't know if it's auto-corrected or not. Burnham and the new commander, Admiral. I'm not sure. President Rilik. What's Rilik's title?
She's the president. Yeah, president. She's president of the Federation.
So they're talking about, you know, about this issue and about how they have to, they name Jovini as the Kwatmanot nun that was basically, you know, led the thing and killed the officer. And of course, you know, it's kind of funny that the Federation, which was like disappeared for 600 years and now it's come back. Now all of a sudden it's really a bad thing to kill a Federation officer, but we'll let that one go. Fortunately, they had put a tracker in the dilithium just in case, so they know exactly where these people are. They don't know what her motive is, and so they need to. They said they need Nivar to sort of give guidance on this thing. Or were they talking about something else? Anyway, Burnham's mom shows up because, of course, she's a Kwatmalat, and she believes that she explains that, you know, there must be a reason why she did this, like, because they just don't do this for no reason. There has to be some sort of lost cause that she's on, and she suggests that she accompanies whoever goes to get her, because only her sisters can bring her in safely without, you know, other people meeting the end of her sword. So they decide to send Burnham and the Kwatmalat to go and retrieve this person. So it'll be a joint mission with the two Burnhams. Meanwhile, Tilly runs into the cafeteria looking for Sue to ask for advice, and she's been dealing with her comfort zone and how she's not comfortable. She's not sure if she's comfortable in it or not comfortable in her comfort zone. So she's been it's been suggested to her that she try new things outside of that. So she's asking Saru for some advice on that. And also, you know, she'd like to water his plants. And of course, there's one particular plant she should keep away from, because apparently, I think he was supposed to be going away, but he didn't really go away. He mentioned something about going and helping out with the Kaminar spaceport, or at least he was making a Zoom call or something with the WebEx or whatever with them about it.
Yeah, I think that's what he implied, yeah.
Right. So, and he says, I'll think about something for you. I'll come up with something for you, Tilly, to help you with your current burden. Burnham goes into the engineering section and she finds Booker there, and she asks to borrow his ship, and you know, she'll promise to bring it back all waxed and washed. And meanwhile, Stamets is there with his three, you know, virtual hollow screens, and, you know, trying to figure out a third. He comes up with this theory for what this anomaly is, which he's calling the DMA, because it's easier to say than dark matter anomaly. So the DMA, what it is, he thinks it's a primordial wormhole. And so 4 out of 5 reasons why it would be. One particular one, no signs of tachyons, which apparently are always there when there's a wormhole. That's the one sort of piece that's not coming through for him. And so they decide that he will go to the Science Institute on Nivar to, I guess, is that where the Vulcans have settled on Nivar? Is that the idea?
Well, Nivar is Vulcan, right?
Okay. Oh, it is the name of Vulcan.
Yes. So it is
with the Romulans too.
Wait, right? I'm which timeline are we in? Because I thought Vulcan got blown up with the two Spocks.
Only in the Kelvin timeline.
Oh, okay. In the JJ.
Yes, in the JJ verse.
In the Jar Jar Abrams verse, right?
That's right. The Jar Jar verse.
Yeah, the Jar Jar verse. So, okay, forget what I said. It's still Vulcan. Okay, so otherwise, because I was going to call them Vulcans, but I guess they're Nivar is Vulcan. Okay, clear as mud.
Yeah, they are the Nivar. They are on Nivar, because that's not confusing enough, as opposed to the Vulcans on Vulcan.
Wait, so is Nivar Vulcan?
Nivar is the planet formerly known as Vulcan, but it is inhabited by the reunified Romulans.
And is it represented by a symbol? never mind. All right, a purple symbol, right? Yes, so it's decided that Book will accompany Stamets. You know, he just promises to not get in the way, and he just would like to go and help and blah, 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 blah. He needs to be doing something. Meanwhile, we see that Gray's body is being 3D printed on this really cool 3D printer. And
which is weird, because didn't we see it standing there the other day?
That was a hologram.
Oh, that was a hologram. Okay.
That was the 3D. That was the 3D
that's
model.
That's what it was going to look actually, like.
Yeah, that's what it's kind of what it's going to look like. And of course, why wouldn't you? I was going to say, why wouldn't you get yourself perfected? But again, he did have one of the moles removed off his hand, kind of thing. This week they're actually making it a corporeal body, and holographic Guardian Z comes. I guess he's a I'm almost getting mixed up. Is it Trill the symbiont or the Trill the host?
Again, this is where another weird one. Trill is the planet. Trill is the people, and the symbionts are called symbionts.
Okay, right. So these aren't they're not really hosting people anymore. But anyway, so yeah, so which is why I guess Gray's kind of comfortable with having existences and different kind of like corporealnesses as part of his race, I guess. Or yeah, race. Let's see what there. Yeah, so he's going to get incorporated into this thing, and there's no guarantee the procedure is going to work. And so, of course, Adira, who's translating for him, because she's the only one that can currently see him and hear him. They are translating for Gray. Is Gray a they?
No, I believe Gray does go by he.
Okay, all right. So, yeah, and of course, you know, I find it odd that, and I guess, you know, we can also hear Gray. So he's saying, tell him this and tell him that. And of course, Adira says nothing like what he says.
loose interpretation.
Paraphrasing is the word, right?
Yeah,
like
no,
just completely changing the tone. And yeah, he gets it, you know, is what she sort of says, right? Rather than what he actually said, which is like a couple of sentences worth of, you know, valuable stuff. And I find that when people are playing translators in movies and stuff like that, like, you know, like, oh my God, this is, you know, if you do that, if you use the red screwdriver and you turn it left 4 degrees, it'll blow up. And then the translator says, it would be a bad thing.
Yeah.
You know, like what, you know, anyway, so yeah, just a minor complaint about that. So Saru, recommends to Tilly that she accompany, or it recommends to Burnham that Tilly accompany them to this, to retrieve this nun back to the main story of the show. You know, Burnham's like, wait, she's like, her combat skills are like the worst. And he goes, yeah, that's okay, but she's going to be with you and she's going to be with the nuns. So she'll, you know, she won't be a problem. Right. And then Dr. Gabrielle Burnham explains to, I don't know what her Quetzalcoatl name is, but she explains that to Burnham that she was Javini's lost cause when she first came to the future, and she took her under her wings and made her into one of these Quetzalcoatl nuns. So she's obviously, you know, invested in, you know, she can't believe that Javini is doing this kind of thing. And they suggest that they require that no phasers go to the planet, which, you know, Burnham's like, what? So they bring them over and they hand them a sword each. And of course, Tilly promptly, clumsily drops the sword on the ground. And, you know, yeah, they're like, okay, let's bring her to a battle. You know, as they arrive, not drive, as it says here in the notes, but as they arrive, they're immediately attacked by mercenaries. And the nun who has one or two lines in the movie, in the show at that point, is killed by one of the mercenaries. And then, of course, Javini shows up, and she's a little upset that the nun got killed, not what she wanted kind of thing. And she says to them, choose to live by leaving the planet immediately, which, of course, you know, they decide they're not going to do. They're going to ignore her. Meanwhile, you know, the process has taken place with Gray. It's already started. They've taken, you know, they've his body's gone, or his incorporeal body is gone, and Adira can no longer feel him. So she's a little freaked out about that. And of course, you know, they're all saying that, you know, Guardian Z says this could take time, and this will take time. And Doctor says this will take time. But again, nobody's ever done this before. So how do they know how long it's going to take or work or whatever, right? You know. Anyway, suspending disbelief, we'll carry on with the story. So they when they land on the planet, they just zap into the planet, because they don't beam down anymore. They just pop in, which probably doesn't freak out people on first contact at all. But they find cocoons with semi-dead aliens in them. And one of them is covered with, it turns out to be Javini's cloak. Again, the autocorrect is having fun with my spelling. And so that's when Dr. Burnham says, you know, I think that this must be her lost cause, because obviously she's adopted these people. At one point, you know, we get the famous line from Star Wars, "That's no moon."
Yeah.
When they determine, or Dr. Burnham just determines that this isn't a moon, it's actually a ship, right, that looks like a moon. And sort of, you know, Tilly starts looking for the tracker with her tricorder, whatever they call the new thing. I don't know if it's a tricorder anymore. They wear them on their wrists now. It turns out it's way above them, like 100 feet or 200 feet above them. And so they find a turbo lift, as they call it, to take them up to that level and the way they can do it. So now we go over to Stamets. And this is, again, I don't get this Stamets guy, but... he's at the Institute. He's talking to the Vulcans about, you know, his theories and stuff like that. And all of a sudden the Vulcans like all tune out and go into a meditative state. And he's like, you know, totally like, get this guy off the planet. You know, he's like, can we have a nap later? Like, let's do the science now kind of thing. Like, very insensitive of all characters on the show to say that, I thought, looking at you writers of the show. Yeah, so meanwhile, so explain to him that they need to do this to go off and sort of process all the stuff, and they'll be back shortly. Meanwhile, scrolling back to the top of the notes to get her name. I'm going to go.
You mean president? The president?
President. What's her
Trina?
Name? President. President Trina says to Booker, you're obviously in a lot of pain and you're wearing your grief on your shoulder. Now I have lost where I am. Yes. Yeah. So, you know, you require freedom from guilt is what you need. And he's a little upset because he's running the idea over in his head about what happened. And I must have missed something. He keeps saying, I wish I could figure out what it was that I missed, and maybe I could have saved my family, blah, blah, blah. Typical stuff. Back over on the moon planet, or the Death Star, I guess it is. Tilly finds a tracker and in the dilithium, takes it out, which I don't understand. And then she disables the engine on the ship, which of course is going to draw Javini in. And then looking on the walls and the hieroglyphics there, Burnham notices that. There's a depiction of a moon leaving a system, like a supernova or something happened, and she determines that all these people, these cocoons down there that they passed, are actually they're all in cryo sleep from this journey, and then they determine that, or they sort out that Javini's lost cause is helping these migrants, you know, survive and get finish their mission, that kind of stuff. So that's where. They show up, and then of course Javini shows up and overpowers Dr. Gabriel and holds, you know, her sword to her throat and says, you know, you better fix this up. Oh, by the people are called Aborians, who she's trying to help, and you know, they why didn't you just ask for dilithium, they, you know, blindly say. Tilly points out that they wouldn't have sent the dilithium to an individual. It would be like they would want to know the species and the planet and who it's going to go to. And of course, you know, again, I don't know why Javini would want to keep that a secret, but apparently she was told she couldn't have dilithium, so she decided to go take matters in her own hand and go and steal some.
They very briefly, like very briefly, said why she was worried about them. So the whole reason people were robbing their grave, so to speak, even though it's their stasis chamber, is that their physiology has latinum in it.
Oh, it'd latinum,
be like
right.
Finding a whole yes. Tomb of people who have, you know, gold sewn into their veins. You'd absolutely see people robbing them.
Yeah, gotcha. Yeah. Have we established that latinum is a currency in this
it's
generation of Star Trek?
Roughly chosen to be as a currency, even though it sort of acts like a semi-bartering system. But it effectively is in a world where you can replicate whatever you want. What is something right. That you can use that's a scarce
maybe
resource?
Maybe the juice that makes the replicator work or something.
Yeah, the latinum is claimed somewhere in Deep Space Nine, I think, is where it might have started as being non-replicatable. So therefore it has, you know, scarcity, which means you can therefore use it as something like a currency.
Yeah. Right.
Because they talk about slips, strips, and bars, and probably more of that.
Yeah, and they press it in gold because gold can help it hold its form or something. That's why they call it gold pressed platinum.
Okay, gotcha. So back in the story here on the ship, the sword to the throat. Burnham offers to fix the ship. Let's fix the ship and fix the cryo tubes or cryo chambers. And Jiminy says, "Sure, Wild Tilly's as you have until she fixes the engines." So kind of weird that, you know, like that's like how long is a piece of string, you know? But because Tilly could take as long as she needed to fix the engines in that case, right?
Yeah.
Back on, I'm going to call it Vulcan.
On
the symbol planet, they disprove the hypothesis that Stamets is trying to postulate because they can find no evidence of those things. Tachyons,
yeah.
Yes, and since they couldn't find any of them, they decide that, are tachyons a real thing? Because the spell check didn't yell at me when I typed up tachyon. Or is it just Star Trek has become so ubiquitous that it's become part of the language? I wonder.
Anyway, yeah, tachyons, I think they're a hypothetical, so they're something that theoretical physicists use as a postulated presupposition of something that exists.
Okay.
There's no proof that they exist, but they use them as if they do.
Well, maybe it's like N in math or it's like a placeholder.
Oh, here we go. I just looked it up. So it was, first theorized in 1967. A tachyon particle is a hypothetical particle that always travels faster than light. Most physicists believe that faster than light particles cannot exist because they are not consistent with the known laws of physics, but no experimental evidence for the existence of the particles has ever been found. So there you go.
Well, if they had a Heisenberg compensator, they could measure the position, right?
They are, in fact, a theoretical
It's a placeholder, in other words, thing. A placeholder value for something they can't find yet. Okay,
yep. Cool.
So they decide to do we do have a witness to the planet destruction. So perhaps we can do a mind meld with Booker to see if what he saw, what he remembered, he may not remember what he saw, kind of thing. So insert president's name here. Will
Tarina?
Does
Tarina?
Sorry,
Tarina.
Trina does a mind well with Booker. Your mind to my mind to your mind. Anyway, Wilma wants a fur coat.
No, Wilma doesn't want a fur coat.
Yeah, so they make him revisit the events and to see if there was a blue cast in the sky, which would be evidence of tachyons, apparently, which apparently just discussed you can't see. Anyway. While there, Booker sees the love in the gaze of his nephew and realizes that, in fact, you know, that makes him feel better about losing him in death and planet destruction and whatever.
But yeah, he has that sort of epiphany of his nephew, his nephew knew how much he loved him before he died, and that's cathartic for him.
But unfortunately, when he comes back out of it, she says that there's no evidence of tachyons, you know, so I said she instead of her name. Anyway, so that disproves again Stamets' theory. So yeah, I don't remember if he goes stomping off, but I imagine he did.
No, he just looks exasperated.
I know.
Because he still doesn't have the answer.
Shoot. Burnham is successful, and we see the ring of pods blink to life as they come back to life. And then, of course, Dr. Gabriel says to Jiminy, your path, your next path awaits. And so Jiminy surrenders and they put her in handcuffs and take her away. And then, of course, they have a ceremony for the dead nun and blah, blah, blah. And then when explaining the whole Coat Malat path theory to Tilly, Dr. Burnham explains that paths end and change and that the path you're on, when you find yourself at the end of the sword hilt or sword about to kill you, the path you're on has come to an end. So now you need to decide, you know, to move to a new path and choose to live or otherwise you stay and you die. And then, of course, she says the whole line about living with absolute candor is the sort of, which is, you know, the episode, one of the episodes we recorded a few years ago, absolute candor. And so they're going to send, they decide in the sort of like end scene there with the two presidents and Vance and Burnham that they're going to send Jiminy back to N'Varr because I guess she is a, I'm going to say it again, Vulcan. and that they decide to let them handle her case rather than letting them making her extradite her, because they're trying to keep peace with Nivarre. They want them to rejoin the Federation. So they're trying to keep things happy. And, you know, Burnham's a little, you know, black and white upset about this because she thinks that, you know, the person should stand trial, even though she had really good reason for doing what she did. She still did kill a Starfleet officer, notwithstanding the other people that died on that ship. But, yeah, and then he explains to her that, you know, like, we're just like instruments here. We're like, you know, the tuba player or whatever. And the president is like the conductor, and she understands the symphony. She gets the big picture. So she gets to make the big decisions. And at the very end scene, you know, Adira has been lying or fallen asleep holding on to Gray's hand, which I didn't discuss earlier. But, of course, you know, Gray wakes up and, you know, eyes open, hands, you know, flinch, and immediately jumps out of the chamber and can move around on this brand new body, which he's never driven before. It's like, you know, taking the new car. You just got your license 5 minutes ago and you jump on the 401 and drive down the road, throwing hugs at everybody. So yes, you know, that's totally believable, but again, this is a science fiction story. So Gray's happy. He's got his new body, and, All's well that ends well.
I guess that's the moral.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a fairly standalone episode, although it does help move the overall story arc along.
But only by like a millimeter. Like, all that did was basically they had a theory, the theory was disproved, and we're back to Nowheresville, right? I guess the only thing that's sort of really accomplished here is that Book finds some catharsis and hopefully won't be just like having emotional breakdowns for the rest of the season.
Yeah. Well, it is a resolution story in that sense, that Gray's journey to becoming a corporeal being again is resolved. You know, Book's angst is resolved. Mm-hmm. I mean, the end scene, which I didn't talk about too, is Burnham comes back to their shared space. He's, you know, lying underneath a canopy of his home planet, which he found a little angsty before, but now he's, you know, enjoying it. So
yeah, not a bad episode. It felt almost like there was two, like, there's an A plot, a B plot, a C plot,
yeah,
but you could kind of flip a coin as to which one is which. Like, none of them really felt a strong A plot, B plot, C plot structure. True. None of them were really like, I really want to get back to that A plot. Like, it was all just sort of, it is what it is. It's been a pretty good kickoff to the season. This was sort of a slow things down a little bit kind of thing. Not exactly a banger of an episode, I think.
But I mean, I think that there may have been a few things. I mean, the political angle about, like, how are we dealing with our planets and what are the rules? I mean, it's a typical, you know, upper management has one perspective on things and middle managers, you know, don't understand why upper management does what it does, and until it's explained to them that this is how things work, right? Because there is the political side of it, because the president does take Burnham aside at the very beginning and says, you know, I know we're letting these people come along, but you're in charge, you know, so you get to call the shots. And yet there was never any point where she put her foot down and said, I'm in charge and this is what we're doing. She kind of just went along with whatever the current situation was, Burnham, I mean, right?
Yeah. I did think the one thing that stood out to me in this episode was the visual style that they used to do the mind meld between Tarina and Book, where, you know, in probably a better fashion than maybe we've ever seen it before, just that, you know, the way that it sort of fades when it fades in with her and then fades out, you see her fingertips removing from his face. I thought that was really well done. Like, a very interesting way to visually show the joining of two minds. I thought that was a really lovely bit of camera work and editing to bring that together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it did seem like you were aware during that whole sequence that this was really happening in his head, which is kind of cool the way they portrayed that. Right?
Yeah, like it was a very
dreamlike and misty.
Yeah, yeah, but well done, and more so than in a way where, you know, obviously limitations of technology, limitations of visual effects and stuff like that. But I thought this was one of the best representations of what that would be like. It really felt very, very more real.
Yeah.
Organic, maybe.
Yeah.
Jaime, highlights?
I've been quietly sitting here waiting for my opportunity to talk about the how the jabronis woke up because they could smell what the rock was cooking.
What?
Okay, so they're called the Abronis or Abronians, which I'm like, the Jabronians? The Jabronians.
Oh my God, that's
were
great.
Were asleep in their little nap. And then they woke up because they could smell what the rock was cooking.
Oh my God.
The moon that they were on.
Right. Oh my God. I love the way your brain works, my friend.
Just sat there ready to ambush this podcast with that.
Oh, that's good. I like it. I like it a lot. Well, I don't think we could top that. Should we move on to Hawkeye?
Yeah, definitely.
Sure.
Good episode this week. Really kind of action-packed. It was the bulk of the episode was, you know, the car chase. We had the two Hawkeyes being caught by the tracksuit mafia and being held prisoner. And we get our first real taste of Maya, the lieutenant of this gang. And
that's Florence Pugh, right?
What?
Is that that's Florence Pugh playing that character?
No, 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 no.
It's not?
No, 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 no. No, that's, I'm sorry, I can't remember her name. I'll look it up. But she is an Indigenous American.
Okay, yeah, because I was kind of, I saw her in the title and I'm like, what?
Yes, sorry, what's her name?
Okay, I've got it.
Alakwa Cox is the young woman's name who is playing the character.
Oh, yes, right. Maya Lopez is the character. Right?
Maya Lopez. This is the character. Alakwa Cox is the name of the actress, and she is Menominee Indian from Wisconsin.
Okay, I was going to say, so Yelena Belova, when does she come in?
She hasn't shown up yet, so
okay.
She will make an appearance eventually.
Okay, so she's the lieutenant of Yelena Belova, presumably, right?
Well, yeah, we're not sure who the boss of this mob is, but we do know that it is a Russian mob, and we know that obviously Yelena is Russian, so there's probably some connections in there, but we haven't obviously seen it come together yet.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. So we get our first sort of taste of her, and particularly interesting because we've obviously over these first two episodes, we got the introduction that through all of the action that Hawkeye has seen over the past few years, Hawkeye Clint, that is, he has permanently damaged his hearing, has now started wearing hearing aids to be able to hear properly. And Maya is deaf and she cannot hear at all. And we see some of her backstory, her origins, how she came into contact with Ronan, which of course was Clint. And then we see them interacting, of course, and she is sort of, you know, disgusted that he doesn't know his ASL, American Sign Language, and actually is just using his hearing aid to sort of get by. And then of course she stomps on his hearing aid, and that sort of becomes a running story through the whole episode is, you know, Hawkeye without his hearing aid and what his experience is. And I thought it was really interestingly told. Hawkeye in the comic books has been deaf since the mid 80s. He deafened himself actually in his first ever limited series way back when, I think maybe 86, 85, 86.
Was it blowing up Arrow or something? Or
no, he was fighting against this villain, and the only way that he could think to stop the guy was to set off a sonic arrow, but he sets it off like with himself right there. He just triggers it and it deafens them both, but permanently. So Hawkeye is not completely deaf, but very, very damaged hearing and has to use hearing aids through the rest of his adventures. So I thought bringing that into the MCU is actually really interesting because that is a big portion of who the character is and part of his life circumstances in the books. But anyway, the point of this was they have this great interaction. He's trying to get the lay of the land, of course. Kate crashed through the ceiling in the last episode. She's held prisoner. They manage to break free and they steal a Cadillac and they go on this great car chase through New York City. And it's a great car chase. You know, Hawkeye's driving. She's firing off all the trick arrows. And yeah, and of course he can't really hear. And they're yelling at each other, but they're not really hearing each other. And, you know, it's really fun to see the sort of, you know, bag, the quiver full of trick arrows that, you know, don't use that one. don't use that one. And, you know,
here, use this one.
Yeah. And, you know, make sure you use the putty one on the tires after she sprays it all over the windshield of one of the cars. And, right. But yeah, again, a really fun, creative car chase scene with, you know, all that stuff happening. And then, yeah, they finally sort of make their way free, and we sort of go from there. Again, a really fun, like it's a good series. It's very enjoyable. They're both very likable, although Clint is definitely coming off as very, you know, very much the heavy in all this. But yeah, we sort of get a little sort of taste of this, and of course it culminates with them going back to Kate's mom's place to try and use her access to the security to try and figure out who's the head of this mob that's trying to get them, and where they can find them and what they can do. And it culminates with Clint with a sword to his neck.
Yeah. The way they end each episode with like a super cliffhanger is really interesting. You know, like, mm-hmm. Right. You don't know what's going to happen. Like it really gets you to want to tune in next episode. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. By the way, so circling back to Aquella, so Alequa Cox, this is the first thing she's been in since high school, right? Mm. She actually is deaf, and she does actually have a prosthetic leg, mm-hmm. which is really interesting. So, yeah.
She's already slated. They've already announced that she's going to be starring in her own spinoff series. Nice. Cool. The character she plays in the comics is called Echo, originally debuted in Daredevil, but has gone on to bigger and better things inside the comic books, including the Avengers. So she is a very rich character. And obviously, you know, it's wonderful to see, obviously, an Indigenous American have some representation in there, as well as somebody who
ESL as well.
Obviously, she has, you know, her hearing impairment. She has a prosthetic limb. It's great to see more representation in there. So she was, you know, phenomenal in this. So.
The limb was also not shown as a impediment.
No,
given that she got like kicked in that leg, and it's like, well, it's not going to hurt me. So, good luck. That would have worked against a normal person. Normal is a bad word. I apologize there. Against a typical person, but it does not against her. Right.
Right. Well, it was interesting too when she was a child, you know, learning martial arts, and she goes to take on the big kid, and he looks down at her leg, and that, you know, immediately he's like, "Oh, this is going to be a cakewalk," and she, you know, tosses his ass, right?
So, yep.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, realizing that she's got the moves anyway.
Yep.
Cool.
Yeah, good. Another good episode.
It's a good show. I mean, so far it's like this has been, you know, for me this is like better than Captain America so far. Or whatever that last thing was, Winter Soldier thing. What was that called?
Last thing we saw was Loki.
No, I'm talking about comparing it to the other. Loki was good too. Loki was amazing too. Like,
yeah, I was trying to sort of rank it in my mind a little bit, because this is theoretically, even though we're only 2 weeks in, we're three episodes out of six in, so
yeah.
we are almost. You know, I mean, we're halfway in.
Well, Christmas is coming. He's got to get that done. That was another interesting thing, was the Russian radio playing the Nutcracker Suite as they're driving away. And then, of course, after the scene afterwards is the Dance of the Sugar Plum Fairies playing as the background music. So they definitely are working the Christmas theme in, you know?
Oh, no, I said it last episode for us. This has been kind of great. Like the way that they've timed it out to kick it off and have it time out to heading towards real Christmas. I'm not sure if you go back and watch this next summer, if it'll have the same feel of it, but just the I'll be home for Christmas part of it. Again, in this episode we saw him have a sort of kind of conversation with his youngest son, with of course Kate.
Why would he do it for like FaceTime? That's what I was surprised by.
Well, because I don't know if he can read lips either, right? And also he's covered in bandages because he's been bashed around.
True.
But I thought it was really interesting that you know, they've done a good job on this one. I've enjoyed it so far, but I found myself sort of thinking, like, where does this rank for me? Where is it next to WandaVision? Mm. Where is it next to Loki? Where is it next to Falcon and the Winter Soldier? Where is it next to What If? You know, what am I missing? Did I miss one? Is that all the shows? Yeah.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, and you know, I think I'm enjoying it maybe more so than Falcon and the Winter Soldier. It's so different feel wise to Loki and WandaVision, just because those were obviously less grounded, more fantasy science fiction-y kind of stories. It's really hard to compare them apples to apples. I still feel like, as much as I love the character of Hawkeye, I really think Kate is a fun character, and I'm glad that mm-hmm. she's finally in the MCU. I really feel like so far the high water mark of the season for MCU stuff is, it's still got to be Loki, just because Tom Hiddleston just magnetic. He's such a great performer. And then the chemistry that he found in that show with the other actors, I still think Loki is the best show of the year for that.
Yeah, but my point was, it's still an enjoyable show. I could watch this on its own. Like, I wouldn't have to compare it to the other shows at all, right? So
Yeah.
Eight or nine out of 10 kind of deal, right?
So. Oh, absolutely. And that's the thing. Like, obviously you don't, I don't want to raise, lower one to raise the other or anything else. I think they're both fantastic. I just feel like I had to pick between them, I feel like Loki was the most substantive and probably the best caliber thing they've done so far. But this has been really good. I'm really looking forward to seeing where they take it and how they stick the landing.
So have all three of us seen the best movie of the year so far?
I have not.
So we'll
keep it kind of light.
We'll do our spoiler-free version of it.
Sounds good.
The spoiler-free version is
Ghostbusters Afterlife, for those of you listening at home.
Ghostbusters Afterlife. So Tim and I went and saw Ghostbusters Afterlife along with our number one fan the other day, and it was amazing. It was really good. It was really, really good. It's funny because, it was obviously, there was Ghostbusters in 1984. There's Ghostbusters 2. There was the rebooted attempt a few years ago with the all-female cast, which I really enjoyed. And then this one was
the animated Saturday morning cartoon.
And of course, the real Ghostbusters cartoons. I feel like in this case, this is probably the straightest line from the original.
Mm-hmm.
Because, they do reference very subtly things that happened in part two, but it really is very much a love letter to the first one, obviously being directed and co-written by Jason Reitman, the son of Ivan Reitman, who was actually alive and on the set. Jason was, in the 1980s working on this, being a kid on the set of this with his dad. It is a very loving and fan servicey without being ridiculous. Like, it's just a well-told story that happens to be filled with great Easter eggs and references and tips of the hat to the original stuff. But it's also just a really good story. The young cast that they have was really, really good. I particularly, Tim, we talked about it as we were sort of coming out of there. McKenna Grace, the young woman who plays Phoebe, the main star of the film, young woman. Again, I think she's 15 now, so she may have been like 13 to 14 while she was making this. She's really, really good. She's really, really talented. Finn Wolfhard plays her brother, Finn, of course, from Stranger Things. And then of course the two sort of main adult cast members are Carrie Coon, who from Leftovers and lots of other stuff. She was Proxima Midnight in the Avengers movies, and Paul Rudd. Again, you can't miss with Paul Rudd, Ant-Man. Like, he's hilarious. Gary Gruberson, like, he's great. Again, to keep it all at a high level, it was just a lot of fun. It ties into the plot and as well as the vibe of the original movie really, really well. And, without spoiling too much, it sets the stage for they could continue this as a franchise if they feel like that there's enough to do there. And I thought it was great. I was surprised. I was kind of like, oh, maybe this will be a little too, on the nose. It'll just be a vehicle to sort of get the band back together and whatever, but it really isn't. It's just a really good, self-contained but referential story.
Yeah,
cool. Sounds good.
Yeah, I mean, again, obviously people have to use their judgment. If you don't want to go to the theater, don't go to the theater, but I'm really glad that I had the opportunity to see it in a theater, especially because I was lucky enough to go as a kid to go see the original in the theater at a friend's birthday party when I was little. And it really felt like it captured the vibe of that really, really well. And I'm really glad I got to see it. And as soon as it gets out there onto the streaming services and all the other ways you can see it, dig in, because it's well worth your time.
Yeah, definitely a good movie. That's all we can say about it.
We look forward to Jaime watching it so we can have a more fulsome conversation about it.
Yeah, there was this part. We can't talk about that. And then there was the other part, and it was
I can't talk about that.
Yeah, there was a cornfield. There was a cornfield. We can talk about the cornfield.
Yeah, I mean, again, you can obviously extrapolate a lot from the trailers about just sort of the vibe of it, and you know the sort of the touches that talk about the past and stuff like that. But really, it does a good job of referencing the past without being too deferential to it, and looking forward. And I think that's where it kind of elevates from a lot of things that are sort of bringing back old material. We've obviously seen that a lot on television and in movies the past few years. You know, this is kind of everything I wanted the rebooted Star Wars stuff to be, where there was references and even, obviously character cameos and whatever stuff, but it wasn't reliant on that. And I feel like that's where Star Wars kind of missed the mark, was that it was so reliant on that old stuff. Whereas this was really about, that stuff happened, but like, where are we going from there?
All right. So we move on to our watch list. What do you say?
Hells yeah.
All right. Let's get Jaime go first.
Mine is pretty quick and easy. There is an HBO original called Street Gang coming out on, I think, regular HBO. I don't think this is Max. But despite its name, it's not, the sequel to The Wire. This is actually a documentary on how we got to Sesame Street and how we sort of take it all for granted nowadays. But back in that time, it was a little bit unusual to have educational television that was meant to not only inform, but also, be entertaining for children in the edutainment in sort of the purest form sort of thing. And how, at least from this trailer, it talks about things like, it kind of wasn't popular in certain areas of the country because it showed a very racially multi-diverse cast together. And some people had a problem with that back then. They certainly might now, but they'd probably not be able to hold it back for that sort of thing. So I'm looking forward to this one. Comes out on December 13th, it looks like.
Cool. Yeah, it was like 1970, I think, was when it came out. So I remember watching it on really fuzzy television, off a I think UHF antenna, because we didn't even have cable back then. So
yeah, I think it came from PBS, right, in the States.
Yeah. So I remember, it was channel 19, or I forgot what channel it was. It was some really sort of blurry, fuzzy channel. Mm-hmm. All the kids at school were talking about it. We didn't have, cable at the time. Couldn't watch it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's cool. But eventually when we got it, we started watching it for sure.
Yeah, it's funny the point that you made, Jaime. I just saw somebody put up a clip about, I don't know if it was from the trailer for this or if it was just from something else, but I remember seeing the clip where they reference at one point, they've got the ethnically diverse, cast, obviously, African Americans and white people and everything else all sort of standing around the street, obviously Latinos. And at one point there, it's a Christmas thing and they wish Mr. Hooper, the local grocer, a happy Hanukkah. And I was like, yeah, that's not something you saw in 1970. Yeah. Right. Like, and yeah,
even dealt with Mr. Hooper when the actor died,
died. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So yeah, I mean, really interesting that they, that it really was a show that just its existence, just the way that they were making it, just the way they put it all together, really changed so much about how we see each other and how we understand each other and how we relate. So yeah, I'm with you. I mean, I think this looks great. I'm way in on this.
Mm-hmm, for sure. Cool. All right. Mine is, again, World of the Worlds, the British French season series. It just wrapped up the final episode. And I got to say, you often wonder, with sci-fi stories, this is, of course, a British production, so it's only meant to be two seasons long. I think it's six episodes per season, maybe eight. I didn't mention before, did I, that it stars Gabrielle Byrne as the main character? Yeah, so it's got some pretty good, interesting actors in it. The lady that plays the American wife from Downton Abbey's in it too, as his ex-wife. But yeah, they got all I'm going to say is that the way they wrapped up the series was really good. I mean, it was totally plausible, made sense. You might have seen it coming, I don't know, but yeah, the ending was really good, and it's kind of what man? You know, like it sort of gives you pause to sort of wonder, like, you know how the aliens arrive and how they're resolved is really interesting. So that's all I'm going to say. Watch it.
Cool. My item for this week is Lost in Space Season 3. So they dropped that on December the 1st. It is only 8 episodes as opposed to the 10 episodes that Season 1 and 2 are. But I've made it through the whole thing as of last night.
You watched the
last couple. Yep. We're recording.
I was going to ask if it all comes at once, because it seems to be trending lately is to give you, like, you know, them once a week kind of deal, right?
Yeah, I mean, since this is an original Netflix production and this is how they dropped them in the past, I guess they're continuing with that. So they dropped all 8 final episodes on December 1st. I managed to finish it by the 4th, so hooray me. Or also, hey, what a loser. No, sleep.
At least you didn't watch the Beatles Get Back.
I haven't watched Get Back yet, although I listened to a pod the other day while I was out about it, and I want to see it even more than I did before, which was to say a lot. So, Lost in Space Season 3, it was a little conflicted when they announced that this was going to be the final season. And I think we talked about it before. There's only so long you can stretch a premise like Lost in Space. You know, you're lost, you get saved, you lost, you get saved. They've been lost and saved like a bunch of times over the first 2 to 3 seasons. So I think this was the right number of episodes in the end. It's only 28 episodes for the entire run. The production quality is quite good. The acting quality is very high. The story is quite well told. And they stuck the landing. And that's, I think you were just talking about that for War of the Worlds, Tim. I think that's one of the things that we now appreciate. And especially in the wake of things like Lost, Game of Thrones, we do appreciate it more so now when these characters we invest in, when these stories are told, stick the landing. And this one really does in a nice and mostly believable premise of a way to finish it up. There is one quibble that I have that perhaps you and I, Tim, will talk about once you finally get through this. But it wraps up in a very nice way, and it is a really good final season. I think now that I've watched the final season and also seen the totality of the show, it's a quality show. I would definitely recommend it. And again, it's not a huge investment. You're talking 28 episodes, less than an hour a pop. You could probably bang out the whole thing in a couple of weeks. It's definitely worth people who are into quality sci-fi. Again, the acting quality is high. Molly Parker is just so talented and
Canada's own.
So beautiful and so talented, and the rest of the cast, again, everybody, particularly the young actors. So, you know, obviously started when they were sort of, you know, in their younger teens. They've got some of them, it's been, you know, 5 or 6 years since they started doing this, and now they're you know, young adults, and they really, it's kind of gratifying and satisfying to watch them evolve over that time too. It'll be weird too for people who now watch it, you know, bang 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 season 1, 2, 3. Because you'll see, you know, the character, the actor playing Will Robinson goes from, you know, a sort of a gawky sort of 13-year-old to, like, he's looking pretty mannish by the time this thing finishes. He's like taller. He grows like a foot over the course of the show. And
I was going to say, like, how much time is supposed to elapse between the seasons? Like, is there, like, it's been 6 months and now here we are? And,
yeah.
You
know, Will's got a beard growing. Season 2 ends on a bit of a cliffhanger of they get lost again and the kids are separated from their parents for reasons that don't need to be gotten into, but the time lapse between the end of season 2 and the beginning of season 3 is 1 year. So
okay.
Even that stretches credulity just a smidge, because when you see the actors, like, again, the actors who play Will and Judy and Penny, they look different. Because it's been, I think, 3 years or 2 years since they did the last one. Obviously, the pandemic being the pandemic and everything else. But they definitely look a little more mature than they did previously. But if you can suspend the disbelief from that stuff, they are all great. As young performers, they were all really stand-up. Mina Sunwall, who plays Penny, who has also been on Legends of Tomorrow this last couple of seasons as Mick's daughter, is really good. Like, she, I think, has potential to be a really big star down the road. Like, she's got some charisma to her, and she really steps to the fore in this season in a really interesting way. But they give them all really a good opportunity to shine. All the lead actors get a moment in the sun that's really good. And yeah, it's kind of everything you want from a last season. So can't recommend it highly enough. Thanks for turning me on to it, Tim. It was a fun ride, and I'm glad I went on it.
Glad you binged it, right?
Well, I mean, I binged season one after the fact, and then I watched season two when it dropped and season three when it dropped.
Alrighty. Cool. Well, I guess that's it for another week. So, hey, Jonathan, if people want to get in touch with you, where would they find you?
You can always find me on Twitter and Instagram as @JPKNews.
Jaime, if people want to touch with you. Jaime?
I do not see Jaime on our podcast notes anymore, on our notes page.
I see him. I think he's trying to talk. I see lights moving. Well, he's Dev with Hair on Twitter and, I don't know, the internets. So, Dev with Hair. And he's in Seattle, so I like that. So my name is Tim Mitra, Dimitra, and I'll be on Twitter. That's where you'll find me. And so until next time, we'll see you in the future.
Bye.
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 You've been listening to the Spotcast Podcast. If you want to find out more about the podcast or see the episode show notes, visit the Spotcast website at spotcast.com. You can get in touch with us on the website or follow us on Twitter at Spotcast. If you have feedback or questions, send us a tweet with the hashtag AskSpotcast. If you like the show, please consider recommending us to a friend, writing a review on iTunes, or pledging any amount at patreon.com/Spotcast. You can find details on how to help us on our website, spotcast.com/sponsor us. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you in the future.
Be right back, he says. Oh, wait. He says, be right back. LOL, we ended without you.
I didn't know I would have vamped for longer. I mean, come on.
Yeah. Now we can talk about, Ghostbusters.
The unfiltered takes on Ghostbusters.
Yeah. And how about that scene where that guy shows up and...
Oh
yeah,
my God, that thing where the character dies. I can't believe. Oh, yeah. Oh my God.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, and that one character that comes back from the dead.
And when they do that thing in the desert, you know?
The cornfield!
Yeah. The cornfield, yes. Exactly. With Paul Rudd, the sexiest man alive.
Yeah. I still not sure how that one worked out, but sure.
Okay.
As I said, until Idris Elba leaves the planet, sorry.
Yeah. Where is this guy? This Jaime guy. This burb guy. Burb. He says burb.
He's getting package deliveries at,
I don't know.
8:30 at night on a Saturday in Seattle?
Well, who knows? Don't know. Should we just end the show? What do you think?
Well, that'll show him.
Yeah. Well, Jaime says goodbye, everybody. See you next time.
That's right.
How you doing? What does he say? What does he say?
How's it going?
How's it going?
How's it going?
Yeah. It's going real good, Jaime. I bet you couldn't be here for the end.
Oh, man.
All right.
That's just going to turn into the Jaime spoof fest at the end. That's great. That's great stuff.
Yeah. All right. Well, we haven't talked about in a while. Paw Patrol.
No, that's because that's his... We don't want to step on his toes. That's his thing.
Oh, that's his thing? We shouldn't talk about Paw Patrol when he's not here?
Okay. I mean, you know, that's kind of his bit.
That's true. whether he likes it or not.
even if it's not his bit, we're going to force it on him. It's his bit.
All right. Well, I'm going to sign off.
Okay.
Bye.
Okay. See ya.
Next time.
Bye.
And I'm back. Oh, meeting's over. I guess I'll fill this in, Tim, for you so you can loop it in. Bye.